I'd love to just open us up in prayer, and then we will dive in. God, I just thank you for this conference, for the people who have put so much effort into planning it and organizing, and for the people who made plans to travel and then maybe scrambled in those plans when flights were changed at the last minute. And Lord, I'm just grateful that we're here and that we've had the opportunity to learn and grow together. And I pray, God, that though I know many of us have to be feeling tired or full, that you would help us to still glean what would be helpful for us in these last few sessions. And I pray that you'd help me to communicate well, Lord, that what is helpful would be taken in by people here, and anything else would just be discarded. And I just thank you for your grace with us, and just the opportunity that you've given each of us to be ministers of your word to people who are hurting, suffering, and Lord, it's just an honor to do that. And so I just ask your blessing on our time. Call us in your name. Amen. Okay, so we're going to be talking about the really lighthearted topic of gender identity this morning. When I was telling people when they'd asked what I'd be speaking on at this conference, and I said borderline personality disorder and gender identity, they were like, oh, okay. And my church has community groups, and one of the people in my group on last Wednesday, I mentioned I was coming to this conference, and she was like, so gender identity, like, what are you going to be saying about that? And we had like 5 minutes, and I was like, well, how do I answer that question in 5 minutes? So I'm grateful I have more than 5 minutes this morning to talk about this really important topic. Now, it's a topic that has been important to me for a few reasons. One is that I have 3 kids. I mentioned this before. I have a 13-year-old, an 11-year-old, and an almost 9-year-old, and they go to public school. And if you're familiar with where our country is right now, you know that in public schools, this is a topic that they are facing, certainly my middle schooler, and it's being talked about at least, if not experienced, in the elementary school as well. And so as I was watching what was happening over the last few years with the massive increase in students in particular who were identifying as transgender or at least in the LGBTQ community, I had a lot of questions about, okay, what's going on and how do we think about this? Of course, I had a general idea, but it was so rare prior to 5, 10 years ago that it wasn't something I'd thought much about. And then as it was increasing, like, I really want to know how to think about this, how to talk to my kids about this. So it was very personal in some ways. And then also from a counseling standpoint, I really wanted to make sure that I had an understanding of this issue, because I do think the church hasn't always responded to this well. Doesn't mean that I think the stance of the church has necessarily been wrong. But the way that we've interacted with people who are struggling with gender identity, I think we've had areas we could grow in. And so I really wanted to understand how to think about this, how to talk about it, how to counsel for it. And I'm curious on the front end, how many of you have counseled someone who's struggling with gender identity? Okay, looks like a quarter of you. It's over the last several years, it's been something that has increasingly been coming up, again, especially in our young people. So it's a topic I've done a ton of reading on. I used to teach a psychology of gender class when I was teaching at the university that I was at prior to switching into biblical counseling. So it's a topic that not just transgender issues, that was about all kinds of gender things, but it was something that I've spent a fair amount of time in. And so I hope that our discussion today will be helpful. I do think, one other note before I dive in, how many of you would agree the tides are also changing a bit on the LGBTQ issue? And you know what I mean by that. Like, there was a while that it was like everyone was, you know, full-fledged ahead. We just need to affirm everyone who says whatever it is they think they are. And now there's been more pushback in the last couple of years, especially with young people, that when a young person is saying, I don't think I'm a girl, when biologically they're a girl, whereas before it was like, we just need to support them, we need to affirm what they're saying, puberty blockers, hormone injections, all the things. Now people are saying, wait a minute, we don't let people drink until they're 21, we don't let them vote until they're 18, we don't let them drive until they're 16, but we're letting 12-year-olds make decisions that can forever impact their physical bodies. Is this wise? Is this good? And so that's not even the Christian community. That's just more and more people in our culture recognizing, wait, the way that we're doing this may not actually be the best way to do it. So that is a good thing. I'm glad that there has been that shift. But I think we still have a long ways to go. So we're going to talk through the diagnosis specifically. That's what this track is. We're going to talk about gender dysphoria, and then we're going to unpack from a biblical perspective, how do we think about this issue? How do we help people who are struggling with it? So let me first kind of go through some diagnostic and cultural trends. This is from the DSM. So originally, in 1980, the diagnosis for someone who felt that they were the other gender was transsexualism. That was the diagnosis they would have received. And the emphasis in transsexualism was truly just that a person who is biologically male thinks or wants to be female, or a person who's biologically female thinks or wants to be male. And that was thought to be, yeah, there's an abnormality in that because biologically their body is one sex and they're trying to live like the other sex. In 1994, gender identity disorder became the term that was used for people who were struggling with their gender. And it added a piece to it, which is actually the language that the vast majority of diagnoses include, which is that it's causing you significant clinical impairment or distress. A lot of the diagnoses use that language of you have to be experiencing significant distress. Now, in 1994, the reality is that most people who struggled with their gender identity were experiencing significant distress. So they would get this diagnosis of gender identity disorder because they were wanting to be the other gender. They recognized, especially in 1994, that that was not considered a normal thing. They felt like the suffering of, I feel like I don't belong in my body, as well as then perhaps feeling ostracized by people in the culture. And so they typically felt distressed. In 2013, the language became even more oriented around distress by changing the diagnostic label to gender dysphoria. So dysphoria, that word, is about the distress, the discomfort that the person feels. So we continue to orient more toward the problem is not, and I want you to hear this, as it's shifted, the problem is not that the person wants to be the other gender. The problem is that they feel discomfort and distress about wanting to be the other gender. Do you recognize that shift there? And so it's no longer clinical. There's not a clinical issue with wanting to be the other gender. That's not the problem. The problem is you feel distressed about it, which also raises the opportunity now for people to say, I'm transgender, and not get a gender dysphoria diagnosis. Because if they do not feel distressed about wanting to be the other gender, they do not meet the criteria for gender dysphoria. And so that's how we can have a whole group of people now who are saying, I'm transgender. They don't meet the diagnostic criteria for any diagnosis. They're just saying, that's how I identify, I'm transgender. Does that make sense? So that this progression in the DSM, I think, has influenced the normalization of a transgender identity. I don't think most people know all that information I just shared, but what happens in our culture is we have things like the DSM or medical diagnoses that trickle down into popular cultures, into our awareness. And so although people might not be familiar with the DSM, they may not know the criteria of the DSM, it does impact how we think about things. And then the culture around us takes that in and is like, oh, okay, it's just normal. There's nothing clinical about wanting to be the other gender. Okay, so let me go over a few more terms here so we're all on the same page. So transgender would be that label that people are going to take when they feel like they are the other gender. Gender dysphoria is the clinical diagnosis for someone who feels distress about wanting to be the other gender. And then another label that has been thrown around a lot is the gender binary. You guys familiar, heard that label before, the gender binary? And is that usually used in a positive or a negative lens in our culture right now? Negative. Yeah, it's talking about the restrictive gender roles that our culture is imposing on people. And so the binary is that there's, you know, just male and female, and it's determined by your biological sex, and it's restrictive and oppressive to have a binary structure for gender, which just recognizing how this wouldn't even make sense like 50 or 60 years ago in our thinking. Like it really has just the popular culture thinking on this has changed so rapidly over the last 70 years that it's kind of shocking, honestly, how much we've changed the way that we think about gender. Because in the past, sex and gender were basically interchangeable. Like if you said, what's your sex, what's your gender? Like people thought that was the same question, and now it is no longer considered the same question. At different times, organizations have really made space for this. I think it was actually higher than this, because what you feel about yourself, you can use that. So where gender in particular, let's break that down a little bit more. Definitions of gender, I just mentioned that it used to be synonymous with biological sex. That was the way to think about it. You defined gender as the same as biological sex. But then it has been also seen as a cultural and social expression of biological sex. That is, different cultures have different norms for males and females, and so the expression of gender is culturally bound. And we can affirm that there are pieces of that are true, right? There are expressions of gender that are culturally bound. If you go to other countries, they may have other ways that people typically present themselves when they are male or female. But it's also not only culturally bound, right? There are things about femaleness that are distinctive, and there are things about maleness that are distinctive. And then most recently, gender is seen as a social construct, right? And so what I mean by this is that it's seen as something that's wholly constructed by culture and social norms. None of it is biologically rooted. It's something that society develops apart from biology. And it's interesting because there's actually some disagreement, and we'll get into that, about whether even among the LGBTQ community, about whether gender is completely a social construct or is it something that is just an expression of culture. You guys tracking with me so far? Okay, so let me go quickly through the diagnostic criteria. They're pretty uninteresting, but I do want to put it in front of you. So for gender dysphoria, which is the diagnosis that we have in the DSM, they describe it this way. It's a marked incongruence between one's experienced and expressed gender, or experienced or expressed gender, and assigned gender of at least 6 months' duration as manifested by at least six of the following. A marked incongruence between one's experienced gender and primary or secondary sex characteristics. Now, let me just make a comment of this before I go on. The first thing I want to mention is just that it mentions, even the way this is phrased, is already pointing to the idea that gender is something we've made up, because it says a marked incongruence between one's experienced gender and assigned gender, meaning it's not something inherent to the person's physical body. It's something that is prescribed to them. So I think it's important for us to kind of notice that. And then the first criteria there, marked incongruence between one's experienced gender and primary or secondary sex characteristics. This would be a person who's recognizing that their body doesn't match the way that they feel about themselves, right? Their primary or secondary sex characteristics are actually causing them discomfort because they so wish that they were the other gender. And I think it's important for us, you know, we're going to talk about this more later, but there's so many layers to this because of the cultural moment that we're in right now. There are people who legitimately are feeling deep suffering because they feel like their body is so uncomfortable to live in. They desire so strongly to be the opposite gender from what they are. And I would advocate, yes, we need to speak truth in love and stand on what is true, but we also need to be so compassionate for people in their suffering, so full of care for them. But then there are also people who I think are more wrapped up in the current cultural moment. And so I think as my daughter is in eighth grade, again, she goes to public school. She, probably of the kids she sits with at lunch, probably half of them identify in the LGBTQ community. And I don't think any of them have a deep discomfort with their sexual attraction or their, you know, they might say that they're trans or that they're bisexual or that they're gay, but I don't even think for the most part they know what those things truly mean. And I know these kids, and they're sweet kids. But that is different. Doesn't mean we don't show care and compassion, but it's different than the person who is truly feeling great discomfort and suffering in their own body. Does that make sense? Is tracking with that? Okay. So that's the first criteria, a marked incongruence. Then the next one is a strong desire to be rid of one's primary or secondary sex characteristics because of that marked incongruence. A strong desire for the primary and or secondary sex characteristics of the other gender. So this would be a person who, you know, especially as they're going through puberty, they really wish that their body was developing like the other gender. And so they start to feel both an increased discomfort with their own body transformation as they're going through puberty and the desire for, you know, if it's a girl who wishes she were a boy, then she wants the deeper voice. She wants those things that boys experience as they're going through puberty because that's what she feels like she is. Okay, just a few more here, and then we'll get out of the DSM. A strong desire to be of the other gender or some alternative gender different from one's designated gender. Again, notice the use of designated. A strong desire to be treated as the other gender or an alternative gender. A strong conviction that one has the typical feelings and reactions of the other gender. And then finally, here is that piece I was talking about before. This condition is associated with clinically significant distress or impairment in social, occupational, or other important areas of functioning. This one stands alone. So when you read the criteria, you have, for 6 months, you have to have experienced some of that list, and then you also have to be experiencing significant distress or impairment in order for a diagnosis to be made, which means that clinically, it's not thought to be a clinical disorder anymore just for a person to identify as transgender. It's just, you could do that. So I think having that context is really important for kind of seeing how we're going to walk through this biblically. Let's spend a few minutes talking about what causes gender identity confusion. There's lots of different ideas about this, different theories that have been presented. As with many things in the mental health world, I would say it ultimately comes down to we don't know. But let me share what we do know. So there are brain theories. There are people who have done research that looked at okay, so are there brain differences in people who identify as transgender? So the idea here would be that you have a male brain that's trapped in a female body, or vice versa, a female brain in a male body. And there is some research that suggests a trans male, meaning a biological female who has transitioned to living as a male, has more similar brain to a biological male than female. Does that make sense? There's a lot of gender terms there. And vice versa. What's interesting is that this research is, first, very inconsistent. So we don't find that consistently to be the case. Secondly, we have the same problem we have in a lot of research, where the question is, so is the brain different because that person has been living as the other gender and perhaps going through the bodily changes necessary to more accurately fit the other gender? Or is the brain different and that leads them to going down the path they go down? And we haven't been able to really answer that question, in part because most of the time when research is being done, people have already identified as transgender. They've already started making changes. So we can't go backwards and say, was the brain different and leading them to do those things? Or did their brain change as they were living as the opposite gender? Because as we've already talked about in this track, the brain and the body, there's a dynamic relationship between our minds, our bodies, and our experiences. They're influencing each other. Think of them as like threads that are interwoven together. What I experience impacts my body and my mind. What I think about impacts how I experience the world and my body. And what's happening in my body impacts both of those things. And so to try to just pinpoint what causes what is really, really difficult because they're all interacting at any given moment. Does that make sense? So that's a little bit about the brain theories. There are also psychological theories. So this would be the idea that people who are identifying as transgender, it's the result of other mental health issues. So there's a psychological issue present. So in this case, we know that there are relationships between gender dysphoria and trauma, anxiety, depression. We know that people who are struggling with their gender identity often experience a variety of other mental health symptoms. So that does make some sense. Again, the challenges here are that this research is typically correlational. So correlational means we don't know what causes what. Is it that the mental health issues cause gender dysphoria? Is it that gender dysphoria causes the mental health issues? Is it some other factor that is causing both of those things to happen? We don't have a clear answer to that question. And then finally, there's the view that gender identity confusion, you know, it's not related to the brain. It's not related to a psychological issue. It's neither of those things. It's only socially constructed. So gender identity problems are due to a restrictive social environment. If our social environment was not so restrictive, people would not struggle with their gender identity. And this is interesting because, on one hand, this fits with our current dominant narrative in our culture. Gender is restrictive. This is why people struggle. If we were less restrictive, people wouldn't have problems with this. But the problems are that some patterns of behavior, cognition, and emotionality are consistent across cultures for males and females. So that it can't just be cultural restriction. And also, and this is an interesting thought to me, if gender is completely unrelated to biology, then why would transitioning be necessary at all? Right? If gender is completely unrelated, then why would you have to change your body? You wouldn't. So there's some disagreement even among, again, the LGBTQ community about this. Is it that this is a wholly socially constructed issue, or is it that people have a female brain and a male body? It's a biological thing that then they have to make their body match what they're experiencing in their mind. Yeah, we'll see how the Bible can help us understand this issue more comprehensively and speak to it in a way that I think is full of grace and truth. A couple more things about current diagnosis. Right now, and I honestly don't even trust these numbers because so much has changed so rapidly that honestly, depending on where you look, you get different numbers. But in the research I was looking at, they talked about how prevalence of gender dysphoria is 0.7 to 2.7%. I think those percentages are actually higher. Though, again, remember, this is looking at gender dysphoria, not transgender identity as a whole. On the other hand, we also see research that 7.6% of adults identify in the LGBTQ spectrum. One in five Gen Z adults identify as LGBTQ. And I think part of this is, and we're going to spend some time talking about this, part of this is because we have defined ourselves through the lens of sexual attraction and sexual identity. So I mentioned my daughter who is in public school, and one of her friends who a few weeks ago, she had told my daughter that she's bisexual. She's like, I'm bi, I'm attracted to both genders. And, you know, the conversations kids are having at the age of 13, I'm telling you, it's wild. And several weeks later, they were walking the track in gym class and having this deep discussion about gender and Christianity. Like, I'm like, Lord, remind me to pray often for my children having these conversations in school. But they were walking the track, and this girl said, I don't actually know if I'm bi. I'm trying to figure it out. She said, I just think girls are pretty. And just, so think about that. Here's a 13, 14-year-old girl who thinks girls are pretty, but because we have in our culture said everything needs to be defined through the lens of sexual attraction, sexual desire, she thinks, if I think a girl is pretty, then I must be bisexual. And she's like, and I don't know if I'm super attracted to boys. And my daughter's like, middle school boys are kind of, it's okay. And so, but that conversation stood out to me because, you know, this girl is confused about who she is because she thinks girls are pretty. And I don't think that's an uncommon experience. I've worked with girls who are 12 or 13 who have told me they're asexual because they're not attracted to anyone. And I have said, you're 12, it's okay. I mean, not really. That's not what I said, but that's what I'm thinking. Is it's okay. You don't have to be attracted to anyone. It's really not the defining characteristic of your life, but that's what they've kind of been fed in our culture, is that it is. And so I think there is a lot of confusion. 60 to 90% of children who experience gender confusion desist by puberty. What that means is by puberty, they typically start to feel comfortable with their own body. That's a wide range, and honestly, I think this is going to shift, and because of how much our cultural views on this continue to change, I don't know exactly what it will look like, but I think previously, research was looking at kids who were identifying as the other gender, wanted to be the other gender. By puberty, they're starting to feel comfortable in their bodies, but typically families were not encouraging them to live as the other gender. In our current cultural moment, where families might be encouraging a young child who wishes they were the other gender to live that way, those numbers might decrease, right? So that when they get to puberty, it might be harder for them to accept their body because they've been encouraged to live as the other gender for a number of years at that point. So there's a lot we just don't know about how some of the shifts in our culture will impact the long-term response of people who are struggling with this. You know, I had a friend back in New York who had more of the cultural views of LGBTQ issues, and her son, when he was three, said he wanted to be a girl, and she just jumped on it and was like, I need to be supportive of who he thinks he is, and does he want to go by his name, and should I change his name, and does he want to go, and she's letting the three-year-old decide, you know, do you want to go by she, and wear dresses, and grow your hair out, and all this stuff, and then you know, and she would talk to me about this and say things like, I'm already imagining, you know, he's never going to have kids. She is going to change her body to look like a girl. I'm like, he's three. He's, like, you don't know. There's so much you don't know. I mean, three-year-olds change their minds a lot. We have not stayed in touch super well since I've moved, but I do see pictures on social media of her kids, and he's a boy. He looks like a boy. Like, he moved through that phase. He did. And I do think it's helpful for us, you know, as you're working with parents, and I do think you will if you've not already, work with parents who have kids who struggle with this. If they're very young, man, one of the easiest things you can say to them is don't stress. Like, young children often don't know what they think or what, you know, they're not locked in on an idea yet. Some can struggle for an ongoing period of time. But at the age of three, man, we don't want to, like, make a huge thing out of something that they just may very naturally outgrow and get to a point of, oh, never mind, I actually feel fine being a girl, or I feel fine being a boy. Okay. I think I appreciate this quote from the Gospel Coalition, just because I think it frames where we have a disconnect in our culture. The Christian prohibitions about marriage, homosexuality, and transgenderism make no sense to most people. I take that in. They make no sense to most people because of their belief that sexuality is crucial for the expression of identity. And behind that belief is the very concept of the modern self. So part of the issue that we have as believers, as biblical counselors, is recognizing that if you are talking to someone who does not share the same worldview as us, we're going like this. We're not even speaking the same language. They can't, you know, and even, again, I think of my daughter relaying conversations she's having with her friends when they're talking about gender and Christianity. These girls have varying experiences with Christianity. One of them said, I just don't understand why God would care who I'm attracted to. And, you know, think about that statement. Most of us probably have a response that we start thinking about, or we know what's right. I'm like, okay, no, but God does care who we're with. But trying to articulate that to someone, like, think it's one of those things I feel like we know, but then when you're sitting with someone who's like, yeah, but why does God care who I'm attracted to? You're like, because the Bible says so. You know, we just start to feel like, I don't know how to put that into words. And so hopefully the session today will help give you some language so that you do feel like you could put some of that into words. But I do think it is the challenge that we're facing is, you know, we're missing each other in how we even talk about it. So expressive individualism, I want to talk about that a little bit because this does explain the differences in identity that we see, is kind of characterized by these things. First, that modern identity is defined by feelings. So in our current culture, what you feel is who you are, right? And for anyone to offer a view that is in conflict with your feelings is considered a rejection of you as a person. So if I feel a certain way and you tell me that you disagree, you've not disagreed with my idea, you've disagreed and rejected me as an individual. And this is why it's so hard to dialogue right now, because to even have a different perspective on this issue, people take that as you hate me. You're a hateful person. I had an experience at the university I was teaching at previously where I kind of felt like I got cornered a little bit on the subject, because there were students in my class that were not believers, and I wanted to have more of a gospel reach with them. I didn't want to make them have a traditional gender ethic. I wanted them to know Jesus. That was at the forefront of my heart. And so I was not really excited to talk about gender views, because I knew that that would be something that would turn them off to hearing more from me. But I got cornered into someone like literally asking me in front of the class, but what do you think about this? And I'm like, okay.
And I said something along the lines of, I believe that God has a design for us that includes our physical bodies and our sexual desires. And I also believe that every single person is worthy of care and respect and compassion. Those are the two ideas I focused on. Even at that, it blew up. It blew up and was, I won't get into the details, but it was a mess. And so I think just recognizing, like, I tried to say it as carefully and as caring of a way, but truthfully as I could, and it still felt to students in my class like I was rejecting them as people. And so it makes it very difficult for us to have conversations. Modern identity is deemed good if it is authentic. You know, again, you're just supposed to live out your true self. I think about in fourth grade, this was back in New York, my daughter was explicitly taught that living your truth was, like, that was part of a curriculum piece, like, live your truth. And the idea being that your truth is different than my truth and different than his truth and her truth, and it's all good. Everyone should live their own truth. So this is a dominant thought that we are seeing in our culture. Modern identity would have us change our physical bodies to match our inward desires. So rather than helping that child who is feeling, like, discomfort in their body because they want to be the other sex, rather than helping them to become more comfortable in their skin, to appreciate the body that they have, our current culture would say, no, change your body to match what you inwardly feel. And we've already talked about how modern identity places a heavy emphasis on sexuality, that sex is your identity, who you're attracted to is who you are. I appreciate Carl Truman said it this way, expressive individualism is simply this idea that the most authentic individual, the most real person, is the person who expresses or performs outwardly that which they are inwardly. So what is inward is real. That's the real you. What your body is almost, it almost doesn't matter. And what's interesting about this is I think Christianity, in Christianity, we have a high view of the body, right? We'll talk more about this, but we think your body matters. And in the secular view of in the LGBTQ community, I think they want to say the body matters, but actually they have a pretty low view of the body because they're saying that you should change your physical body to match what you're feeling, whereas we recognize our bodies are significant. They're a gift from God. They matter, and so we affirm the dignity of the body. Okay, I got to keep going for the sake of time. Let me contrast this with a gospel identity. So modern identity, I went through some of those points. A gospel identity is first based on the reality that God is sovereign over all, right? That we live in God's world. It's not my world made to be the way I want it to be. It is God's world. Psalm 24:1 says, the earth is the Lord's and everything in it, the world and all who live in it. Our identity is not subject to personal interpretation. Our feelings don't have the final word. God in his sovereignty has the final word. Gospel identity is also rooted in Christ, who he is, what he has done for us, and who we are in him. Jesus compels us. He says, whoever finds his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. This is a stark contrast to our culture's modern definition of identity. But I also think it is part of what makes Christianity so compelling. There is something about the upside-down nature of the kingdom of God that I think is so foreign in some parts of our culture that it just makes people, it can make people, it doesn't always, but it can make people lean in and say, what is that? Why would someone want to live that way? Gospel identity also emphasizes finding our contentment in Christ. So again, if we think about the person who's really struggling with their own
their own physical body. They feel like they would be more comfortable as the other gender. We can empathize with that person in their suffering, and if they're a follower of Jesus, we can also encourage them that true contentment is never going to be found in trying to remake our lives according to our desires, but rather aligning our lives with God's design for us, with His desire for us, is going to bring the fulfillment, or at least more of the fulfillment than we'll ever find elsewhere. Okay. I appreciate this from John Stott. The astonishing paradox of Christ's teaching and of Christian experience is this. If we lose ourselves in following Christ, we will actually find ourselves. True self-denial is self-discovery. To live for ourselves is insanity and suicide. To live for God and for man is wisdom and life indeed. I love that. True self-denial is self-discovery. And we've experienced this, right? We've had our own moments of wanting to pursue something in our lives according to our desires, our design, and we lay it down for the sake of following Jesus, and we feel that. True self-denial is self-discovery. To live for ourselves is insanity and suicide, but to live for God is wisdom and life indeed. Okay, let me talk a little bit about, I mentioned if you guys were here on the Borderline talk, I talked about worldview then, and I want to bring that in again because I do think it helps us frame out where some of the disconnects are. So again, worldview helps shape our view of gender. Worldview is answering questions like, who am I? How did the world begin? What is wrong with our world? What is the solution? And how will it all end? So if we are looking at this, and again, I'm doing this overly simplistically for the sake of time, but what we have is, let's start with the first question. Who am I? How did the world begin? So in our current culture, they might say something like, who are we? You are who you say you are. It's self-definition. You get to identify who you think you are and live whatever way you want to live. And also, the world began as a result of impersonal evolution. You know, there's no God. He didn't do any of this. According to the Bible, we believe that we are people made in the image of God and that God designed and created the world and the people in it. How does this relate to gender? Well, we also believe that in general, God has designed us as male or female, made in His image, and that He is the designer and the creator. So we're going to already see this differently just by that question of who are you? You're either self-defining or we're looking to God for that and trusting His wisdom in how He created us. In terms of what is wrong with the world, our current culture might say it's being prevented from living as you want to live, right? That's what's wrong with the world. I want to be like this, and I'm being stopped from getting my desires attained. What's wrong with the world is social injustice. This is a issue of how people are treating each other. What's wrong with the world is behavioral restrictions that impede my self-expression. I'm not able to express myself fully the way I want to. Furthermore, from the Bible's perspective, we would say what's wrong with the world? Sin, right? Sin broke our world. It entered through Adam and Eve. It separates us from God. It creates a fallen creation and causes us to hurt other people, to be hurt by them, and to hurt ourselves. That's the ultimate problem. And then from a gender perspective, it's that sin distorted our understanding of ourselves in God, right? And so we may be envious of things that the other gender has, that we wish that my body looked that way or I was treated that way. And so I'm discontent with the way I've been created because I have things that I long for that would fit better with the other gender. And then the solution, again, our current culture might say, is I need to be given the freedom to fully express myself the way that I want to. It's finding freedom to live as I want to live. It's self-love. It's being affirmed. It's validation. Through the Bible, of course, we know that it is in Christ that we are provided hope and redemption. And as it relates to gender, we're going to trust God as the designer of our lives. You know, I've been this tall. I'm 5'8", a little over 5'8". I've been this tall since I was 12. So you imagine like 12-year-old me, all the boys are shorter, all the girls are shorter. It's like all the pictures for my entire childhood, actually, it's like I'm a full head taller than everyone in my age group. And I did not like it. I do not like to be standing out, and I truly stood out. Like, I think of I played softball when I was probably 9 or 10 years old, and I'm, like, standing there with my whole team, and it's, like, my head, and then everyone else is like this. And there was a part of me that was like, you know, let me, like, just bend down. I don't want to be this tall. Or when you start 12, 13, you start getting to the age where girls, like, they like the idea of a little heel. And I was like, I cannot wear heels. Like, if I do that, then I'm, like, towering over everyone. And height is an interesting one because we recognize that as much as 12-year-old me may have wanted to say, I'm not 5'8", I'm 5'2". It wouldn't have worked, right? If I said to you, I'm not 5'8", I'm 5'2", you'd be like, sure. But when it comes to gender, we don't have that same consistency. Whereas if I looked at you and said, no, I'm a man, you most of our current society would say, oh, okay, nice to meet you, Mr. Clay. You know, like, it's just, it's interesting how we have inconsistency there. Both have to do with the body, but they are differently treated in light of, current thinking. Okay, let me keep going. How will it all end? You know, in our current culture, living your truth will lead to a better world for everyone. According to the Bible, we know from Revelation the world will be made right as it relates to gender. One day we will be content with how God has made us. We'll be content with the bodies, you know, again, the resurrected bodies, perfected bodies. But we will be content as God has designed things. So I think I put this in front of you because I think it does help lay out where the points of disconnect are so that we can hopefully get at the conversation at the right points where people are actually wrestling with rather than, you know, just trying to say, the Bible tells me that boys should live as boys and girls should live as girls. We want to be able to speak articulately and compassionately about these issues. I think another piece that was super helpful to me, this was from Andrew Walker, who wrote God in the Transgender Debate. He framed out that some of the worldview implications are these three ideas of authority, knowledge, and trustworthiness. So authority is this idea of who has the right to tell me what to do, knowledge, who knows what's best for me, trustworthiness, who loves me and wants what is best for me. Depending on the worldview you're operating out of, you're going to answer these questions very differently. So let me put that in front of you. In our modern culture, in terms of who has the right to tell me what to do, we may answer that like me, right? I have the right to tell me what to do, and maybe experts, if there are certain kinds of experts. They might have the right to tell me what to do. But in biblical Christianity, the one who has the right to tell me what to do is the one who created me. In terms of knowledge, who knows what is best for me? Again, self, I know what's best for me. Maybe some experts, people who affirm me, who affirm what I believe about myself, they know what's best for me. We would say it's the one who designed me. He knows what's best for me. And then trustworthiness, who loves me and wants what is best for me? Again, I do. I love me. People who affirm me, those are the ones who love me. And we would say, who loves me? The one who died for me. And so we are looking to a different authority. We're looking to a different place for how we even think about where to go next if you're struggling with this. And I think this is helpful for if I'm meeting with someone who is a believer and they're struggling with their gender and sexuality, then I can approach them from the lens of, okay, you believe in God. So let's explore God's sovereignty then. Let's explore that he's the one who died for you, and can he be trusted with this very difficult and painful part of your life that you feel like doesn't match what you want. If I'm working with someone who's not a believer, who's struggling with this, then again, you're coming at it from a different angle because they don't see God as the authority. Like, that doesn't mean anything to them. And so you've got to start from a different place to try to grab them in. Does that make sense? Okay, so I'm going to spend just a couple of minutes. I know I'm almost out of time here, but I want to talk for a couple minutes about what the Bible does say about gender. So I'm going to have to go through this faster than I want to. But first, the Bible affirms the creation and design of two sexes, male and female, and that they are very good, right? So we see that. I won't go through the scriptures for the sake of time, but the Bible does consistently have that message of two genders, male and female, being created in his image. We could spend time talking about, people always ask about the intersex population. It's such a small percentage of the population that in a one-hour span, I've decided not to devote a ton of attention to that. But certainly there are lots of resources out there that address that population as well. Secondly, the Bible also affirms the value and significance of our bodies. So I think the Bible even talks about how our bodies will be resurrected in the age to come. They matter. And so we want to affirm that a person's physical body is significant. And more than trying to get them to change their physical body, could we help them to grow in their comfort level with their physical body? Again, Carl Truman, I appreciated what he said here. Our bodies are an integral part of who we are. I do not occupy my body as I might occupy a house or spacesuit or a deck chair at the beach. On the contrary, it is an integral part of me, inseparable from who I am. I love the way that C.S. Lewis says this. Christianity is almost one of the only, is almost the only one of the great religions which thoroughly approves of the body, which believes that matter is good. That, and think about this. This is a huge conversational point, I think, for people that you could explore in a counseling context. Which believes that matter is good, that God himself once took on a human body, that some kind of body is going to be given to us even in heaven, and it's going to be an essential part of our happiness, our beauty, and energy. We can spend time talking with people about how the body matters so much that when Jesus came to earth, he took on bodily form, God himself. Let's not neglect that. That is a huge counseling point. I love this point. This is another place you could land in counseling for a long time. You are not your own. You belong to God. I really appreciated Alan Noble's book, You Are Not Your Own. He said this about this idea. If you are not your own and belong to Christ, then your personhood is a real creation, objectively sustained by God. And as a creation of God, you have no obligation to create yourself. Your identity is based on God's perfect will, not your own subjective, uncertain will. And so, in not just, we don't want to just present this as you don't actually belong to yourself. You know, you belong to God, as if that's a bad thing. That's not a bad thing, friends. It's a beautiful thing. Like, let's land in the beauty of belonging to Jesus. And Alan Noble does such a good job in his book of pointing to the problems that we face by spending our whole lives trying to belong to ourselves. That so much of our anxiety, the things that we're facing in our culture right now are this fight to belong to ourselves, and it's destroying us because we don't belong to ourselves. We belong to God. This is an important point. What does the Bible say about gender? I think we need to make some distinction between what the Bible actually says and cultural stereotypes. So on one hand, we know that the Bible affirms sexual differentiation and sexual complementarity. We see that. And so if I had more time, I'd spend more time here. But we can see that part of God's design is that men should live as men and women should live as women. However, there are varied expressions of masculinity and femininity in the Bible that are valued, right? And so we have Deborah, the warrior, who goes into battle, who is a woman. We have David, who is an interesting character. He's a warrior who fights lions and bears, and he pours his heart out to the Lord through tears and great expression of emotion in the Psalms. We have Jeremiah, the weeping prophet, that not exactly the picture of masculinity that we have in Western culture. So let's recognize that we are not prescribing something to people that the Bible does not prescribe. If when I say that men should live as men, that doesn't mean that they cannot experience emotions. That doesn't mean that they can't love caring for children. I'm being grossly stereotypical right now, but bear with me. It doesn't mean that they can't love cooking. And for women to live as women, it doesn't mean they can't appreciate cars and sports and in all those kinds of things. In fact, I think that this is where the LGBT community doesn't do themselves favors, because what they do is they look at the little boy who loves dolls and says, oh, you must be a girl, instead of saying, you can be fully a boy while playing with those dolls. You do not have to change your body to want to hold a baby doll or to love pink or any of those things. You can be fully a boy while doing that. And for the girl who's rough and tumble in her play and she's the tomboy, she can be fully a girl while having more stereotypical boy interests. They do not, it doesn't have to get in the way of that. Does that make sense? So let's not prescribe something to people that the Bible does not prescribe. Real quickly here, I think, just to lay this out further, some of the characteristics commanded and encouraged of all believers, again, I'm stereotyping, but we have feminine characteristics, so to speak, of all believers are called to be gentle, tender-hearted, turn the other cheek, weep with those who weep, be peacemakers. And then we have more masculine characteristics of all believers, that you're supposed to stand firm, be immovable, be ready for battle. We use language that's more masculinely oriented. But these things are indicated for everyone who follows Jesus. And so there's a need for us to be discerning in how we are prescribing that men should be men and women should be women, that there's room for variation of how that's expressed, while also recognizing and affirming that there are some distinctives. And truly, I think the heart matters in this, too. Is the man trying to be a woman when he does those things? Or is he just really interested in something that's more stereotypically female? Is the woman trying to live as a man when she does those things? Or is she just interested in things that are more stereotypically masculine? Okay, so real quick, secular therapy for the gender confused. I think you guys are probably familiar with these things, but in general, this is gender-affirming care, so whatever it is the person believes, that's what they should, you know, they're affirmed to continue living that way. They may be encouraged, if they're young, to do puberty blockers, hormone injections, surgical alterations. They may be encouraged to transition their clothes, their hair, to have a new name or pronouns. Therapy is actually typically going to focus more on dealing with secondary distress. So you're not actually treating the gender issue. You are just helping them to deal with their distress, their depression or anxiety, or their dissatisfaction with the transition process. They're not impeding it at all. And this is a concern for people who are Christians, who have young people who are struggling with this, is who are they sending their young person to go talk to? Is that person going to affirm something that's not consistent with what they believe is Christian? I think as biblical counselors, I can't spend much time on these things, but I do think I'd want you to hear first and foremost that the gospel should remain the first priority. We are not ultimately about trying to make everyone have a traditional gender ethic. That doesn't save anyone. There are lots of people who have a traditional gender ethic who are straight, who are not, they don't know Jesus. So let's keep the gospel the first priority, right? The first thing that we're looking to, while also being people who live out our convictions with grace and truth on the issues of gender and sexuality. We can talk about natural law. I think natural law is basically that idea that even though people may not share our values, there are some things that we can we can talk about in a way that makes sense to them. The height example I gave earlier would be one. It would make sense to people that I can't say I'm 5'2 or 5'3. They say, no, you're not. You can't. I'm like, okay, so why is that the case with my height? But if I said I'm a man, you would say, okay. You know, you're pointing out an inconsistency in natural law. This is not something that I would do. Again, I'm not trying to convince people in counseling. That's not my primary objective. But it could be a discussion point to help, as if they're wrestling, if they're engaging in the dialogue, to help them see, how do we make sense of this then? We need to be humble and compassionate and listen well. We need to know our audience. So when it comes to working with someone who's struggling with gender identity, my first question is, what in particular are they struggling with? Are they in the depths of despair about the fact that their body does not match what they want? I'm going to approach that one way. Are they wrestling with God? Why would a good God create me this way to struggle this way? I'm going to approach that a different way. Are they wrestling with the fact that they feel like no one understands them and they don't have good community? I'm going to approach that a different way. So let's not look at this as one size fits all. You want to get to the heart of the issue. If the person is struggling with their gender and sexuality, know your audience. Who is the person that's sitting in front of you? What is the particular issue that they're struggling with? We can offer biblical clarity on gender and sexuality. We want to disentangle gender stereotypes from gender identity. We want to help the person learn to accept themselves as God created them. We can emphasize God's presence with us in our suffering and pain. We can point to the lasting contentment we have in Christ alone, help them root their identity, their understanding of themselves in Christ. These are just, again, I could spend a lot of time talking about each one of these, but they're places that we can go in dialogue with someone. It doesn't have to be scary, right? We can sit with someone who's struggling with this and find, again, what is the heart of the issue for them, and then how can we walk with them carefully through that and in a loving and compassionate way. I'm a couple minutes over. Again, I apologize. I did not leave room for questions, but we have a panel coming up, so hopefully, I know all of the talks probably have additional questions. So I'll let you guys go for your break, and we'll come back together in about 12 minutes or so for the panel. Thanks, guys.